Buffett, the sage of Omaha, summed all of this up much more eloquently than I can. He explained deal-making as an act of pure hubris. He wrote in a shareholder letter the following. Many managers were apparently overexposed in impressionable childhood years to the story in which the imprisoned handsome prince is released from the toad's body by a kiss from the beautiful princess. Consequently, they are certain that the managerial kiss will do wonders for the profitability of the target company. Such optimism is essential. Absent that rosy view, why else should the shareholders of Company A want to own an interest in Company B at a takeover cost that's 2 times the market price they'd pay if they made the direct purchases on their own? In other words, investors can always buy toads at the going price of toads. If investors instead want to bankroll princesses who wish to pay double for the right to kiss the toad, those kisses better pack some real dynamite. We've observed many kisses, but few miracles. Nevertheless, many managerial princesses remain secretly confident about, or serenely confident about the future potency of their kisses, even though their corporate backyards are knee-deep in unresponsive toads. This is brilliant. Musk, no doubt, suffers from this kind of excessive optimism and self-regard that Buffett ridiculed. Of course, again, this room can attest he's not alone. But unlike in the typical corporate takeover, Mr. Musk was betting mostly his own money. So even from a social standpoint, there isn't much we can say, but that the shareholders should definitely do this deal. In response to Musk's offer, the board did what boards do in these situations. They said no. Delaware specifically permits them to follow the Nancy Reagan defense. This just say no defense empowers boards to decide about the merit of hostile bids. And it's uniquely American. In most other prominent jurisdictions, when there are barbarians at the gate, boards must raise the portcullis and let them in. The trade-off, of course, is clear. One view, mostly associated with Marty Lipton, my former boss, is that boards have a duty to protect the kingdom from the barbarians, or, at a minimum, negotiate for better terms of surrender. The other, common among activist investors, is that boards cannot be trusted to serve the interests of shareholders, whether because they're unfaithful agents or overly optimistic about their own or management's capabilities. Consider Time versus Paramount. In the late 1980s, Warner Media offered a nearly 100% premium for Time. Time's board said no, alleging the buyer was a threat to the quote-unquote Time culture. The Delaware court upheld the board saying no and using various defenses that drove Warner away. Those poor Time shareholders. They got nothing for the Time culture, which they got nothing but the Time culture, which turned out to be worth a lot less than the Time board thought it was. Although criticized today, Time is still on the books, and more importantly, the practice. As NYU law professor Ed Rock noted about the Twitter board following the Nancy Reagan defense, adopting a poison pill that was ironclad, quote, it gives the board a chance to evaluate the bid, whether it makes sense to sell the company. And if they're going to sell the company, whether it makes sense to sell the company to him, meaning Mr. Musk. This is the prevailing view. Empowered the board to walk out under a flag of truce to parlay, but with their finger firmly planted on the self-destruct button. Maybe they can squeeze a few dollars more out of the back end, the argument goes. In this Genesis story, T. Boone Pickens, who could only have been from Texas, is Adam. His company, Mesa Petroleum, made a 2-stage offer to buy Unocal. Since stage 2, which was debt, was arguably less attractive than stage 1, which was cash, the court viewed the deal as potentially coercive to shareholders. Even sophisticated, economically rational shareholders might sell against their own interests in this situation. There might be a more attractive deal to come, the thinking goes. Boards can play defense even when the deal isn't like T. Boone's. As a result, boards can adopt poison pills and negotiate even against all cash, non-coercive offers. This means the Nancy Reagan rule is over-inclusive and it causes mischief. Which brings us back to Twitter. Although many blue checks thought Mr. Musk was a modern-day Genghis Khan, it isn't clear the board believed that he was there to loot Twitter. In fact, just 10 days after adopting a poison pill, the board accepted his offer. The Unocal framework seemed vindicated. The stock price jumped to over $50 on the news. Then on May 13th, Musk announced the deal was on hold, pending a review of spam and fake accounts. Although he later tweeted he was committed to the deal, probably at the request of his lawyers, bless you, the stock price plummeted below $40, where it remained for several weeks until July 8th, when Musk sent a formal termination letter. As people read the actual deal documents, it became clear that Musk didn't have a very good case on the merits. It's possible to condition deals on verification of this or that asset, the number of bots on the platform, or anything else. This deal did not do that. As one of Twitter's lawyers argued, you don't do due diligence to get out of a merger agreement, you do it to get into one. Over the next month, Twitter's stock price rose consistently from about $33 to a close of $44.50 on August 15th. The market was skeptical, but not entirely dismissive of Musk's ability to walk away, perhaps subject only to a billion-dollar termination fee. Then on August 23rd, a whistleblower, the amazingly named Mudge Zatko, alleged Twitter was, if not a giant fraud, not exactly what it seemed. Security was bad, Twitter was hiding lots of stuff about privacy and how it handled accounts and various violations of law. No one would have cared much about Mudge, but for the fact that Musk was looking for any piece of flotsam or jetsam to get off this sinking ship.